Welcome to another special edition of Oncology Today. This program focuses on the management of paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Carlos DeCastro from Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video program featuring a presentation by Dr. DeCastro. In my conversation with Dr. DeCastro, he presented a number of cases from his practices, but before we got into that, I shared with him a thought I had as I listened to him presenting the data. So, first of all, wow, incredible presentation. I'm actually having a flashback. I don't know if you know Marinel Gounder. He's an oncologist at Memorial who specializes in desmoid tumors. So I did a session like that, like we're doing today with him a couple of months ago. You know, they have these, they presented this at ESMO, these GSIs, gamma secretase inhibitors. And I was like, you know, trying to follow the biology, you know. But, and of course here, to me, it's even more complex. So I want to explore that with you a little bit before we get into your cases, the biology that you were going through there. But, you know, from a more macro perspective, before we start getting into the details, there's also a little bit of an analogy in these situations that they're both very rare conditions. And, you know, when I heard the story about the GSIs, you know, it was amazing, you know, the how much they've learned about it, given how rare these tumors are. Then they do a phase three study with patient-reported outcomes. You're presenting, you know, amazing data, all these different agents that are very rare condition. And, you know, of course, it brings up, I guess, economic issues in terms of, you know, investing that kind of money in a small number of people, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I'm just kind of curious about your perspective being in this situation, learning so much about a rare condition. And I guess one of the things that I always think that I thought about with him and I was thinking about with you is, are we learning things that are going to have implications beyond this, you know, in terms of biology and therapeutics? Can you see that what we're learning here in terms of what you've been describing here today in terms of PNH, having potentially learning about this, having other applications even outside of oncology?
They certainly are having huge implications because complement is involved in a lot more diseases than we ever thought before, including autoimmune diseases. So rheumatologists are very excited about these drugs, ophthalmologic diseases. Including things that are fairly common, like macular degeneration. Apparently, complement plays a big role. And one of these drugs has actually gotten approval for an eye drop that uses it to treat macular degeneration. So yes, neurology is excited about it. Dermatology is excited about it. Some of the renal doctors are excited because of renal damage caused by complement. So, yes, there's a lot of excitement about taking these into other areas. And there's even some implications for oncology itself as we get into the complement field. Some of the monoclonal therapies, antibody therapies that we're using need complement to actually kill the tumor cells. And so can we improve that in some way? So, yes, there's a lot we're learning about complement that, yeah, I agree with you. I didn't learn about complement med school and forgot about it until I came to Duke. And Wendell Ross, who was the big PNH expert here, was the one that introduced me into the hey, here's what's going on with this disease, and remember complement. So,
yeah, I haven't thought too much about complement until I started getting ready to work with you today, and that's kind of my next question, which is, you know, you were flying through a lot of biology there, and I'm not going to try to attempt to get into all of it, but I would like you to maybe peel off a little bit. I never know whether or not it's just me or most oncologists are having a hard time following all the new biology that's coming out. But just to start with complement, can you just, you know, like at a med student level, can you talk about what it is and, you know, how it functions?
So complement is really a set of proteins that's actually very highly evolutionarily conserved. We can detect rudimentary forms of complement down to the earthworm. So it may have been one of the first forms of an immune system that we had. It usually is activated in some way or form in humans. There's three pathways we can activate it through. Usually the antibody antigen pathway is the one we most commonly think of that complement then gets activated through C4. There's the lectin pathway, where bacterial sugars will activate. And then the alternative pathway, which is always, as I mentioned, on a little bit in our bodies. All of these converge then at C3 to cleave C3, which is why it's the new fancy target, and it needs the cofactors B and D that I mentioned. Once C3 is cleaved, it cleaves C5, and then it goes stepwise to C6, C7, C8, C9. And that C5 through C9, those proteins, once cleaved, will form a pore into a cell wall, usually, hopefully bacteria, but in the case of PNH, it's doing it on the red cells. The pore forms, osmolality will work, and water will pour into the cell, and hopefully lysate is what will happen. And that's how complement works. Now, other fragments, as I mentioned, the C3 fragments can also bind to bacteria and lead to inflammation and to uptake by the macrophages in our body. So there are, it does more than just lysing the cells.
But again, complement is protein or proteins?
Complement is all a set of proteins, a series of proteins that are sequentially cleaved. C3 is where it's amplified even greatly. So you get a viral infection once C3 starts cleaving. It cleaves itself some more, and there are some proteins we have to shut it down. But in fact, there are cases where we don't have those proteins that lead to atypical HUS, for example. So there are inhibitory proteins that are out there too. But once we start activating the system, it really amplifies and revs up. And that's when we lead to hopefully lysing the bacteria and or getting them to be taken up by our macrophages.
Some of the things you went through, you know, in beautiful detail with your slides, but more in terms of like how you explain it to people when you're on rounds. So let's just start again with the basic biology, what's going on with this disease, and how was it that, you know, they started to figure out what the pathophysiology was?
It's actually an interesting historical story. So the first cases of PNH were actually described probably right at the turn of the 20th century. There was an English physician who probably had the first case of a leather worker that he dramatically documented these dark urine episodes. They were not related to the cold, so it was not a paroxysmal cold hemoglobinuria, and it seemed to be related to infections and other things. And so that was probably the first case report. And about 10 years later, a German physician named Strubing had a series of cases very similar to this. And he postulated that something was causing the blood, maybe when we were asleep, they would accumulate CO2, and that would lead to a little acidosis. And that was causing the lysis of the red cells, which was kind of insightful because it wasn't until 1930 that people like Thomas Ham developed the Ham's test. We acidified serum, and that would activate complement. And when you threw that on PNH red cells, they would lyse. That was the old test we used to use for diagnosing PNH. Complement itself wasn't discovered until, again, the turn of the century. And at that time, it was felt to only be activated by antibody antigen. And in PNH, we could never find an antibody antigen reaction to explain why these cells were, you know, being lysed. So it wasn't until the 1950s that the alternative pathway was discovered, and people said, aha, it is complement that's lysing the red cells. And at some point, people had started noticing that there were proteins missing in PNH patients' blood cells, including white cells. So they're missing leukocyte alkaline phosphatase and other things. And in the 70s, somebody said, hey, you know what? All of these proteins that are missing are GPI-anchored proteins, which led the Japanese group, Tiro Kinoshita, to do some investigation. And he quickly found that the PIG-A gene had mutations in almost all these PNH patients. There are very rare cases of other GPI genes that are involved, but for the most part, it's always GPI, the PIG-A gene.
You mentioned that these are all somatic mutations. Any
correct
ideas in terms of what causes them, you know, ionizing radiation, or et cetera, or what?
Well, that may play a role, but certainly I think most of it is probably just normal hematopoiesis, where the stem cells have to divide to give rise to new stem cells, and that's how we keep replenishing our blood. And unfortunately, not being perfect organisms, we can get mutations in different genes whenever we do that. Most of the time it's in junk DNA, but every once in a while we'll hit a gene that's important. In this case, we have actually, somebody's done a study that looks at what we'll call normal subjects who they found at very, very low levels they could detect a PIGA gene mutation, and that they had no evidence of any disease going on. So as I mentioned, there has to be a second something that comes along, and that's probably, again, something similar to aplastic anemia, where there's this T-cell mediated assault on the bone marrow that prefers normal stem cells. And in fact, the Italian group has found a T-cell that looks like it attacks the GPI anchor itself, and therefore that would explain why it would go after normal stem cells and not to the PNH cells that are missing it.
Is this sort of an autoimmune mechanism or like infectious?
Yeah. No, I think it's an autoimmune mechanism. Again, rare, but autoimmune. Now, what triggers that? Nobody knows. Yeah. And we can go back to the basic biology of complement then. So as I mentioned, complement, when I explain to the students that I'm teaching, you know, complement can be active to a little bit throughout our bodies. It always is. Levels do go up a little bit at night, which may be why we see dark urine in the morning in patients. But certainly any sort of stress, any infection, surgery, even heavy exercise, strenuous exercise, can activate more complement. And when we do that, you start to see more lysis of red cells, and that's when the urine will turn dark as that hemoglobin starts to go into the kidneys. Complement, as I mentioned, is a series of proteins that just get activated.
How do you visualize the purported purpose of complement? Like, what does it do? These proteins.
I think it's there to help fight bacteria. I think it was a system that we have in addition to our usual antibodies and other.
In other words, does it kill bacteria directly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Some of it's through lysis. Some of it's through, again, extravascular uptake by the macrophages. But it's a big part of inflammation.
When you have an antigen-antibody reaction, is it complement mm-hmm. that's actually sort of carrying it through in terms of causing the outcome?
In some but not all cases. It's actually more specific to the type of infection. So that's interesting point. Yes. Yeah. So.
I was going to ask you about you mentioned a couple of times the connection to meningococcal infections. What is it about the immunology of those infections?
Not clear why that one is so dependent on C5. And again, it was something we kind of discovered when we were looking at kids who were deficient in complement such as C5, and later that they only would get nicerial infections.
And can you talk a little bit about what was seen before this new wave of biology and agents came along in terms of sort of what happened with these patients, how long they lived, I know they had a lot of thrombotic complications.
For sure.
Can you
comment
also on the types of thrombosis? I thought that was very interesting also.
Yeah, so the average survivals of PNH prior to any treatment, effective treatment, was about 13 to 15 years, depending on whose little study you believed. The majority in the U.S. and Western world, the deaths were due to thrombotic events, interestingly enough. So, and we don't know what causes those blood clots, which made it difficult. But we learned quickly that we put them all on anticoagulation, of course. Aspirin didn't seem to help. Blood thinners, they still tended to re-clot through. So it was a very difficult time. Once a patient got a blood clot, they would tend to clot again and again. And so it was a sort of a harbinger that we better do something. And those were the patients we used to try to get to transplant right away because, again, we didn't want them to die from a serious event. Not always the easiest thing to do. With the onset of C5 inhibitors, and now even with the more proximal inhibitors, that instance of blood clotting has gone way, way down. It's, 90% reduction in the instance of blood clots. And so we are much happier now. We don't routinely prophylax these patients anymore. We don't put them on blood thinners or anything else. There's just not felt to be a need for that. But we have to be aware of it. Why the clots occur in funny locations, we've not figured out either. It's part of the mystery of what the heck causes blood clots. One theory is that as the red cells lyse, they release little microparticles of membrane that are usually inverted, and those can serve as procoagulants. But that doesn't really explain the location of why we get blood clots in, for example, the liver as opposed to other sites. They can get normal blood clots too, don't get me wrong, but there does seem to be a higher instance of funny locations.
You mentioned blood clots in the liver. Do you ever see like hepatic failure?
Mm-hmm. Or did they? Oh, yeah. No, they can. Oh, yeah. No, I've had back in the old days that patients that would die from Budd-Chiari syndrome just having hepatic failure. Yeah.
Another thing you kind of mentioned that I was just kind of curious about is pregnancy in these patients. Yeah. Again, what was it like before the new drugs came here and what's it like now?
So before the new drugs came out, it was miserable because we would actively tell women of childbearing age that they should not have children. Their instance of maternal and fetal outcomes were horrendous. And part of that was the higher risk of clotting just from the pregnancy, and then combining that with PNH would lead to all sorts of problems. So we would actively tell them, no, you should not consider pregnancy, you should consider adoption or something else. And that was never an easy conversation to have with a young female who might be getting married soon or anything else. So it was not good. Eculizumab is the only one that we have any data to say, yes, this has really improved the outcomes with pregnancy. That was mostly case series that were done. Richard Kelly published an article on it. I think that was in New England Journal, saying, hey, this drug looks like it really is effective at helping pregnancy outcomes. And they measured breast milk and the umbilical cord blood, and there was no evidence that it really crossed the placenta or caused any issues to the fetus. So it is the one that if the patients are getting pregnant or considering pregnancy, we will put them on eculizumab. The others, we just don't have the data to support that yet. So.
At ASCO, I was showing this quote from an investigator, actually he's a GU investigator, who started out the quote by saying, back in the day, in 2019, and so, which kind of gives you an idea how quickly things are moving in prostate cancer.
Yes.
So when you say back in the day when you told people not to get pregnant, like how long ago was that?
Well, let's see. Eculizumab is, 15, 16 years out now? So,
yeah, right. So,
and even then, when it first came out, we didn't have any data to support pregnancy even then. So it's probably been over the past 10 years that we've been able to say, hey, things have changed. We probably can get you through pregnancy safely, and we need to keep you on this drug.
Really amazing commentary on the volume of clinical research going on right now, that in 10 years you could do a presentation like you just did, going through eight different drugs and randomized trials, phase three, et cetera. And I want to sort of, again, before we kind of get into your patients and, explore a little bit about sort of how that works, a little bit more. I mean, your talk, you go through in detail on many agents, but maybe you can kind of make a little bit more macro discussion in terms of the two different, it sounds like there are two different pharmacologic strategies that are being used.
Correct.
And then within those two strategies, which one comes first? And within each class, how do you choose which one?
Fair enough. And not sure I'll have the answers to that question, but certainly there are two big classes now of treatments. One would be the terminal complement inhibitors, the C5 inhibitors, of which eculizumab and ravulizumab are the two that we have that have the most experience with, because again, I think eculizumab is like 16 years out now. So we have a lot of experience with that agent. We feel comfortable with that agent. But as time went on, I think we learned, hey, there are suboptimal responders, what's going on? And that's where we discovered the C3 coding was causing an issue. And at least in the United States, I think ravulizumab is probably the predominant one that we use nowadays. I'll come back to cost of these agents because you brought that up a little while ago. The proximal inhibitors now include the C3 and the factor B and factor D inhibitors. A different target. Again, our concern initially was, would these cause more infections? We have not seen that yet to date, so I think we're all feeling better about that. I think that in part reflects the fact that kids who are deficient in, congenitally deficient in C3 and other earlier forms of complement never develop a great immune system, whereas in PNH patients, no, they've had complement around, they've developed their immune system. So even now, without blocking C3, we aren't seeing that high infection rate that we were all concerned about. So a different biology going on there. The C3 inhibitors, the proximal inhibitors, clearly can block the extravascular hemolysis, and probably as standalones can block intravascular hemolysis alone. So I think we're all hoping these can be used as monotherapy rather than what they did with danicopan, which was to use it as a add-on, because our concern with adding on one expensive drug to another one is you're really going to skyrocket costs. So we're hoping the monotherapy approach is going to be effective, and certainly that's what the studies are looking at and seem to indicate. Is one going to be better than the other? I don't think we know that yet, and that's the hard part. Is there's a reluctance, for example, pegcetacoplan was approved 2 years ago. There is certainly a reluctance on the part of physicians to, you know, switch from one agent that they've been using all along to a newer agent without clear-cut evidence that it's going to be superior than the other one. And I think that's a hard little block to get over for people who believe pegcetacoplan may actually be a better target. Nonetheless, if you have a suboptimal response to a C5 inhibitor, then I think pegcetacoplan is going to be a wonderful drug to start out with or use in that situation. The cost of the agents is very high. These are what are considered ultra-orphan drugs, and by congressional mandate, the companies are allowed to charge a high fee because they have to recoup their costs for developing these drugs. And that was part of the Orphan Drug Act that came out. They are priced similar to other ultra-orphan drugs. I don't know the current cost of something like eculizumab. When it first came out, it was close to like $500,000 a year. And of course, as adults, we were like, what the heck? There's not going to be an insurance company that covers that. But it turns out that insurance companies learned from young kids where they were developing all these, you know, drugs for treating various congenital disorders that were ultra orphan, that the insurance companies are not worried about the cost of these drugs as much. It's the moderately high priced drugs like we use for breast cancer that are just so common. That's what's causing them to worry more and more. These drugs, it's such a drop in the bucket because it's so rare. They're like, no, we're not going to take bad press because we denied you from having a life-saving or magnificent treatment for your disease. We'll cover that cost, and it's not going to be an issue. So for the most part, these drugs have been covered. I will say the when eculizumab came out, the company that owned that did a wonderful job of setting up managers to help, you know, get through the insurance rigmarole. And so patients were very happy that it went smoothly. And I think all of them followed suit now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it actually is cost effective, but I do imagine it probably prevents a lot of morbidity and costs from hospitalization, et cetera.
Oh, yeah, no, it's clearly a life-changing drug in terms of how patients feel. And then there is data coming out for eculizumab suggesting that, you know, survivals have improved to close to normal levels as compared to the 13 to 15 years that I told you before.
Getting back to these proximal drugs, you also mentioned an agent called iptacopan, and I think you said it was oral. Is that the only one of these new drugs? Is that the only one that's oral of all these?
No, so iptacopan and danicopan and the next generation, vermicopan, are all going to be oral drugs now. I don't know how insurance is going to play out in that when they get approved, but I can't imagine that patients would prefer to be on oral drugs rather than the IV or sub-Q.
So one more question before we get to your cases. You mentioned extravascular hemolysis. Can you explain what that is?
So extravascular hemolysis is occurring outside of the blood vessel, usually in macrophages that are in our liver and spleen. They will take up these cells, and then they will destroy them, you know, outside of the blood vessel. So with that, we will usually see a high reticulocyte count, but we don't get the marked increases in LDH or bilirubin that we see with the intravascular hemolysis, where they're just releasing those products right into the bloodstream.
So this is reminding me more and more of the desmoid thing, because when I first sat down, I'm like, how am I going to talk about this? How are we going to talk about this for an hour and a half? And then once you get into it, you're like, we're never going to be able to cover this in an hour and a half. So one more thing again, before we get to the cases I was curious about, was the nitric oxide thing and the symptoms like esophageal spasm and all. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So when a red cell lyses in the bloodstream, free hemoglobin is released right into your bloodstream. And it turns out that free hemoglobin has an avidity for nitric oxide, which is a gas that it turns out red cells regulate the amount that we have in the bloodstream. And it controls our smooth muscle contraction and relaxation. So if you then release hemoglobin into the bloodstream, you bind up all your nitric oxide, and all your smooth muscles end up contracting because of that. And so these patients commonly have symptoms of esophageal spasm. I can't swallow. I feel like I'm having a heart attack. Abdominal pain from all the smooth muscles in the bowel wall is going to contract. So they commonly complain of, I've got this belly pain. It won't go away. And, you know, everybody scratches their heads. I don't know what's causing this because you do CAT scans or whatever. You don't find anything. And so until we know they have PNH, it can be a little mystery of what's going on.
Do you see that in other causes of hemolysis?
Not often. You can if the hemolysis is brisk enough, but not that often. So other things like sickle cell disease obviously have a lot of other pains, but they're causing by blocking up your vessels with the sickle cells, not necessarily by the same mechanism. Yeah.
So I'm really curious to hear about your cases, particularly how the path they took before they got to you, because I can only imagine some of the stories you must hear when people finally get diagnosed after being, you know, going to a bunch of different docs. So let's go through.
I didn't do this case, but there's a case that I inherited from Wendell Ross, who had it as a teenager. She's now in her 70s. And she's dramatic in telling you how many complications she used to have, you know, how dark her urine used to get. She got a flu shot once that activated complement, and she ended up in the hospital. And, you know, when she got on drugs, she said, this was incredible how much different I feel now. I should have presented that case, but we'll go through these cases. They're good too.
All right. Let's start with case one.
Yeah. So case one was a case that just points to how difficult a diagnosis can be. 41-year-old, she was transferred from Altheids Hospital to my university in 2009 with pleural effusions, abdominal distensions. She had marked ascites. And when you got into her past, it was incredible. She'd had 4 miscarriages. She'd been labeled as having Crohn's disease, presumably from just having abdominal pain. There was no documentation of how this diagnosis was made. And she reported repeated episodes of abdominal pain. In 2006, she had developed what had been called the HELLP syndrome during pregnancy, and she underwent a stat C-section, fortunately successfully. But when you look at what HELLP is, hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, which can come from hemolysis, and low platelets, this could have easily been her PNH, and they just called it HELLP because they didn't know. Postoperatively, she had a complicated course. There was a question of whether she had clots in her liver. She had a DVT at a PICC site, and she got on warfarin for 6 months. She also reported to us that as an outpatient, she'd undergone workup by a hematologist for hemolysis. No clear cause was found. Not clear if PNH screen was ever sent, but interesting that somebody had actually seen she'd had hemolysis going on. And then by 2008, she started having real problems with abdominal pain. A CT scan showed what was called liver inflammation. I don't know what liver inflammation looks like on a CT scan. Ascites, a big spleen. You can see her platelets were a little bit low. She was anemic. Her bilirubin was up. A liver biopsy was done. And this even suggested that she had the possibility of clots there, but apparently an ultrasound did not show that. By 2009, she was getting much worse. She clearly had problems with ascites. She had clear Budd-Chiari syndrome on an MRI we did. She was transferred there. We did ultrasounds that showed thrombuses in her IVC or portal veins. Again, the MRI showed the Budd-Chiari, and they actually reported something. All that iron that she'd been filtering through her kidney was being picked up now on the MRI in her kidneys. Our consult team saw her. The fellow was the one that said, hey, why don't you get a PNH screen on this patient, which I thought was great on his part. And sure enough, she had PNH. She was so thankful that somebody could finally put a name to what she had and knew what was going on. That was the biggest thing. I was like, wow, I don't even care what you do with me. The fact that you can tell me what I have is just a huge step forward. She was treated with anticoagulants, and then eculizumab had come out, and she got started on that. And she did incredibly well. All her symptoms improved over the years. Her ascites went away. Her liver got better. We switched her to ravulizumab in 2019, and she continues to do very well. So she's one of the great success stories of somebody who obviously had a delay in diagnosis, but was treated with C5 inhibitors and has done very well with that type of therapy, despite even having blood clots.
What a great story. Did she attempt a pregnancy again?
No.
And in her current quality of life, performance status?
Well, life is great. I see her every 6 months, it's just to monitor blood counts. You can see her here. The last time I saw her, white count was 3. Hemoglobin 10.2. So it never hit normal, but she's able to function very well with a hemoglobin 10.2. Her platelets are still a bit low. Her LDH is now normal. So she's done amazingly well on the ravulizumab.
You mentioned the PNH screen. What does that consist of?
PNH screen is a combination, at least at Duke, of two tests. We recommend that you do a test both on red cells and on one of the forms of white cells, either granulocytes or monocytes, in part because if the red cells are lysing briskly, you may miss all the PNH. For red cells, we use a flow cytometry assay. You're looking for the absence of any GPI-anchored proteins, such as CD55 or 59 on their surface. So it's kind of a backwards. We're looking for the red cells that are missing. And anything above 1% of the red cells missing those proteins will be called a positive PNH test or lacking GPI anchor. For the white cells, we now use something called the FLAIR assay. This is the fluorescent aerolysin lysis assay that Rob Brodsky developed. He found that the Aeromonas bacteria actually had a protein called aerolysin that binds to the GPI anchor itself. So you're not looking for one antigen, you're looking for GPI anchors. And so you fluorescently link that. It's still a flow cytometry type of test. Again, it's much more sensitive because we're looking for the absence of GPI anchors rather than one antigen that might be on the GPI anchors. And so we do that on white cells, such as granulocytes or monocytes. Above 1% missing cells is called a positive screen. Usually we don't start to see symptoms until they get above 10%. So we call that sort of subclinical PNH if you're below 10%, because it's unlikely you're going to have any clotting problems or hemolysis going on. Having said that, I have seen a case, so I don't want to say it's 100% that's true, but subclinical PNH usually is a low level. And with time, that size may increase as the PNH cells start to expand and take over more and more. And that's when you may get into more complications.
I'm curious, okay. Are any of these patients managed by general medical oncologists in the community, or pretty much everybody goes to a tertiary center?
Well, they may go to a tertiary center just to get an opinion. So that's commonly what I see is patients that have a hematologist, but because he's only had one case in his lifetime or they're the first case, he goes, no, why don't you go there and get an opinion and we'll do whatever they say. And so we're able to help advise. So that's why I can see them, usually every 6 months or even yearly in some cases if they have to travel a long distance, because there are not a lot of PNH experts.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking, we're doing surveys all the time of these docs. And they're our primary target audience. The docs are taking care of breast cancer and bladder cancer and AML, exactly. et cetera. And I wonder, what fraction of general medical community based oncologists in the United States have managed a case?
Not very many.
Really?
I will tell you. Yeah.
Yeah, I can believe it. A lot of times, newly approved drugs in common tumors they haven't used. So I'd imagine even less common. Well, hopefully this will be instructive. They can sit down with this thing the next time they get a patient.
I love it, yeah.
All right, let's
great.
Let's hear your second case.
Let's go to case two. Yeah. Case two. This is a 41-year-old female who presented in January of 1998 with shortness of breath, heavy menstrual periods, and was found to be pancytopenic. And her workup showed aplastic anemia at the time. She was treated on the outside with immunosuppressive therapy using HEG and cyclosporin, and she had a complete response with a bone marrow biopsy 1 year later that was normocellular. She did well for a long time till 2013. Then she started noticing more fatigue. And when she went and saw her hematologist, her hemoglobin was down to 5.7. So, of course, she was fatigued. Her platelets are just mildly decreased at 142, or white count may be mildly decreased at 3.4. He did another bone marrow biopsy because he was worried her aplastic anemia was relapsing, and it was not. She had normal cellular marrow, normal FISH, normal cytogenetics, and this hematologist was bright enough to do a peripheral blood flow cytometry, which showed that she did have PNH, so he was good. She actually got started on eculizumab in 2013, and she did okay on it. Her hemoglobin went up to 9.4, but she still had a LDH of 268, and she still was feeling a good bit of fatigue. He actually sent her to a neighboring institution to consider for bone marrow transplant, and they didn't feel she was a great candidate with those numbers. And she continued not to feel great, and she continued to need transfusions about every 3 months. And they actually increased the dose of eculizumab, which is something we commonly did in those days, to 1,200 milligrams, and still no response. She still needed transfusions. You see here in 2017, she's still quite anemic, hemoglobin 7.6. Her LDH is still mildly elevated. Her bili's actually up. And she has a very high reticulocyte count. And we were starting to see her about this point. And at that point, I said, hey, you know, there's a lot of data coming out about having C3 coating on your red cells. We actually sent a Coombs test. She was weakly positive for C3 fragments. And we actually entered her onto the clinical trial of Pegasus, which is the pegcetacoplan phase 3 trial in 2019. And her response was incredibly good. She has no complaints anymore. She feels better. You see there, her hemoglobin is now 14.6, stone cold normal. Her LDH is normal. Her bilirubin looks good. She's been on commercial product after the study was done and continues on commercial product without any issue. So she's one of the great successes in what would be called a suboptimal responder due to extravascular hemolysis.
So another incredible case. What's the connection between aplastic anemia and PNH?
Interesting connection that was recognized back a long time ago. We think that connection likely reflects this T-cell assault on the bone marrow. Again, in aplastic anemia, it's more a T-cell against all stem cells. They don't have a PNH clone there and knocks everything out. So you look at a marrow and it's empty. And presumably, some of these cells like to survive, so they get a PNH phenotype. They get a mutation, basically that allows the stem cell to survive, and that's where the disease eventually evolves into. Again, some PNH patients have just cytopenias right from the start, and we've never had a phase of aplastic anemia. So presumably, similar T cell mediated attack on the bone marrow going on.
Another question, you mentioned a few times along the way allotransplant and the problems with it, but does it work to any extent?
Yeah, but with a very high morbidity and mortality rate. Regis Delator in France did a study with EBMT looking at, you know, retrospectively what happened with patients with PNH, and it was not a pretty picture. In fact, he said, you know what, I would not recommend a transplant for these patients unless it's the, you know, last thing they can get that's going to help them. So, yeah.
I was just trying to think about the biology of what actually is going on when you do an allo transplant, how it affects this whole system you've just been describing.
Well, you'll replace, you know, the mutant stem cells there with normal stem cells. So presumably they will take over and you won't have the PNH anymore. So yes, it could potentially be curative. But with a high morbidity mortality, obviously the transplanters don't want to do that. So,
all right, let's hear your last case.
All right. Case number 3. There's a female who was diagnosed with PNH in 1995. She was initially treated with steroids. In April of 2005, she was started on eculizumab. She had an initial response to this, but then developed fairly marked hemolysis, again, likely from this C3 deposition on her red cells. And we actually put her on a phase 1 trial at the time of pegcetacoplan. She felt much improved on that. She actually moved to Cleveland and was followed up there on study. And then she became pregnant, despite them telling her she cannot be pregnant on a phase 1 trial for obvious reasons. And she had to come off study. She delivered a healthy child. She was briefly on eculizumab through that pregnancy. And eventually she got placed back on pegcetacoplan when it was commercially available. Despite that, she moved back to our area and we started seeing her. And she had these episodes of breakthrough hemolysis usually being treated with several days of pegcetacoplan in a row, but it kept happening. She was also then given some steroids that would help her too. And I saw her back and said, you know what? This is not good that you're still breaking through on this new drug. Let's see if we can get you some of this new drug called ipticoplan. And so we got her compassionate use. I had to go through our IRB to get that. And she just started that less than a month ago. I just saw her back two weeks ago. She's feeling better. She did right at the transition have another flare. So she got a little prednisone as she was transitioning from one drug to the other. But since then has not had any flares. Her hemoglobin is up to 12.9. She's doing well there. Her LDH is normal. And we're hoping that this new drug prevents that breakthrough hemolysis, but we'll have to wait and see. So,
interesting
case. New drugs. Yeah.
How many people have you treated with ipticaflan?
I only have three or four right now that I've treated with it. One of the problems, as you mentioned, is rare disease. As I do more and more studies, that they want people who have failed or had suboptimal responses. I'll say to eculizumab. I started running out of patients to put on trials, going, wait a minute, I've used this drug and they're doing fine. Now I can't put them on study of the next drug because I don't have any more patients. So it's made it an interesting time.
That is really amazing. About how many patients do you have in your practice with PNH?
Oh, I am probably seeing between 50 to 70 PNH patients a year. Now that's, again, seeing them usually managed on the outside by somebody else. And I see them every 3 months or every 6 months or, in rare cases, once a year.
You know, one of the interesting things I keep thinking about the desmoid is that they had an advocacy group. Even though it's a very rare condition, there's a lot of prevalence. And the advocacy groups really drove the phase 3 trial and were very important. Yeah. Are there any advocacy groups with PNH?
Yeah. So the biggest group that probably advocates for the patients is the Aplastic Anemia MDS International Foundation. They have lots of patient education materials. They used to have live conferences. Now I think they're more virtual for the patients and their families. They've done a lot of advocacy for patients with bone marrow failure, including PNH. In addition, the patients themselves with this disease are very active. They have their own chat group website that they so if a new drug like an oral drug starts coming out, they all know about it. They'll come to me saying, hey, I heard about this new drug. Oh, really? I haven't heard of that yet. Yeah, kind of thing. So they are very active amongst themselves in communicating what's going on.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. DeCastro, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.